Well, good morning to all of you. We are going to be talking this morning from Genesis chapter 31. So for those who are not here regularly, because you live a distance away, I have been preaching stories from the book of Genesis on the patriarchs, and so we're going to continue that this morning. And I'd like to begin with a children's class. So the children who would like to come forward, maybe they'll come over on my left-hand side, and we'll have a little lesson for them. See if we can all fit up here. Might be challenging. This is a problem with not having pews. You know, in pews, we could just squish you all in like sardines, but we can't do that, can we? You all aren't sardines, are you? Okay. Well, welcome to all of you. Our children's class has grown, too. Maybe the hurricane brought you all up here. Did you all come with the hurricane? Maybe not. So I am going to read a verse. So Jeremiah 17:23 says, "But they did not obey nor incline their ear, but made their neck stiff." Have you ever had a stiff neck? No, you all are too young to have stiff necks. You talk to some of the older people out here and ask them what it's like to have a stiff neck. It's not fun. Anyway, they made their neck stiff. So it wasn't even something that happened by chance. They did it on purpose, that they might not hear nor receive instruction. That's a lot of stuff. But we're going to be talking a little bit about listening to God's voice this morning and what happens when God talks to us. So does anybody know what this is? Yes. It looks like a phone, doesn't it? It even tells... What kinds of things could you do with this, do you think? You could call people. That's right. You could look up stuff. That's right. Some people do look up stuff. Is there anything else you could do with it? Can't think of anything. Yes. You could read the Bible if you have a Bible on your phone. I do have... You can listen to music on it. Mm-hmm. Yes. You could watch videos on it. Okay. You could even use it as a calculator. So I thought about this, and I figured out, does anybody know what 16 times 3,567 is?
Me.
Yes, Elise. What is it?
A dinosaur walking.
A dinosaur walking. No, that's wrong. So I would not know this, except I did it on my calculator on my phone, and it said it was 57,072. That's important, isn't it? Probably not. So one of the things that nobody mentioned is that other people can call you on your phone. So that's kind of a weird thing. Do you think other people call very often? Yeah, so I still am a doctor, actually, but when I practiced in Indiana, I would do something that was called taking call. Does anybody know what taking call is? No. Yes, Grayson. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You could do a lot of things like that. So taking call... Basically, a little tiny hospital in the town where I was at, and they would call me from the emergency department, and they would say to me, "We've got a patient who's really sick and needs to go into the hospital." And I would say, "Oh," because I was really groggy because it's that night. And I would say, "Well, let me talk to the nurses." And so anyway, I would tell the nurses to do some things for the patient. So I actually woke up in the morning and would go see the patient. So I was taking call. But one night, when I put my phone back on the hook, I didn't put it on quite right. And then the hospital couldn't call me anymore. And eventually they got through to me on my pager, but that was very sad. But one of the doctors, does anybody know what a pager is? So a pager is the thing you wear on your belt, and people can send signals to you even if you don't have cell service. So that's handy in some places of the country where there's not good cell phone service. So one of the doctors that I worked with, and I'm telling this story because it makes me feel better about putting the phone down wrong, he was out and he lost his pager and he couldn't find it anywhere. And they finally had to give him a new one. And then the next year in his garden, he was tilling and lo and behold, the pager was there. And it didn't work anymore. And the strange thing is, it didn't come up with a little pager bush. You would think it would come up and there'd be little pagers on it, but it wasn't. So I guess they don't bear true. But one of the other doctors that I worked with, she delivered babies. And the hospital was trying to call her, and they could not get in touch with her. And they kept calling and calling, and she wouldn't answer her phone. I guess she'd left it someplace. And so there was a lady who was going to have a baby, and she needed to be at the hospital. And you know what they did? What do you think they did? Grayson. They had the baby at home. No, the lady was actually at the hospital. You'd think smoke signals, right? That's what I would do. No. No, they called the police, and they had the police go out to this doctor's house. And the police told her, I won't say her name, but they said, "Doctor, the hospital needs you." And then she went to the hospital and helped out. That was a good thing, wasn't it? Do you think God ever sends the police whenever he's trying to get in touch with us? No, he probably doesn't usually. Although if you did something really bad things, the police could be messengers from God, couldn't they? Who do you think God sends to tell you to do something? Jesus. Jesus did come. So there's a lot of stuff in the Bible, but I believe that God puts teachers and parents in your life to tell you what you should do. So whenever your parents tell you, you know what, I think it's time to clean your room this week, that might be God calling you to clean your room. That seems kind of strange, doesn't it? But I think it's true. So you can go back to your parents now. So we're going to be looking at Genesis chapter 31, as I said. And as I was preparing this sermon, my mind went to Uncle Tom's Cabin. So how many of you have read Uncle Tom's Cabin? Well, many of you have. It's a classic. It was written by a lady by the name of Harriet Beecher Stowe, and it was a bestseller in the years leading up to the Civil War. It was the best-selling book in the United States in the 19th century, behind only the Bible. And for you students, Harriet Beecher Stowe was a terrible speller. So I thought this was really interesting, because sometimes we think that spelling is really, really important, but Some of the people that we think about in history were not good spellers. And Harriet Beecher Stowe was one of them. John Bunyan was another, and he wrote Pilgrim's Progress. And I found out that the man who invented Scrabble was a terrible speller. That seems like a really strange game for someone who's a bad speller to invent. But I guess he was good at coming up with games even if he couldn't play them himself. So anyway, the reason why I thought about Uncle Tom's Cabin was that Uncle Tom was a slave. And over the course of the book, you see his fortunes decline as he's sold to meaner and meaner masters. And he ends up in the household of a man named Simon Legree, who is awful to him. And I won't give away how the book ends, so if you all haven't read it, you can still read it and figure out. But it's not a real upbeat ending, we'll say. But Uncle Tom was a slave, and he had no control over his working situations. His only option, if he didn't like his master, was to run away. And that didn't seem like a very good option for many slaves. And so as we think about our own work experience, some of you all don't have experience working yet. You're just in school, and then you're stuck with what teachers you have. But there are many times that we're in situations where we feel like we're working too hard and we're not getting enough pay for what we're doing. And since I got out of my training, I've worked in two different offices. First, I was in Southern Indiana for about 17 years. In the last 7.5 years, I've been in Brookneal. But I was not a slave. And if I wanted to leave, I could go wherever I wanted, I guess within reason. Ephesians 6, verses 5 through 9 says, "Bondservants, be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling and sincerity of heart as to Christ, not with eye service as men pleasers, but as bondservants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, with good will, doing service as to the Lord and not to men, knowing that whatever good anyone does, he will receive the same from the Lord, whether he is slave or free. And you masters do the same things to them, giving up threatening, knowing that your own master also is in heaven and there is no partiality with him." And I read these verses not to make a comment on slavery, but to say that regardless of our work situation, we have a responsibility as followers of Christ to give our all, even though our bosses are not Christians and even though they are not easy to work for. And I suppose the blessing is that none of us are slaves and we are able to leave work situations if and when we don't feel like it's the best place for us to work. So we're coming to Genesis chapter 31, and we discover that Jacob has been working for the wrong boss for 20 years. And his boss doesn't treat him very well. He's ready to leave and find somewhere better to live, and maybe even be his own boss. So let's read Genesis 31. "Now Jacob heard the words of Laban's sons, saying, 'Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and from what was our father's, he has acquired all this wealth.' And Jacob saw the countenance of Laban, and indeed it was not favorable toward him as before. Then the Lord said to Jacob, 'Return to the land of your fathers and to your family, and I will be with you.' So Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah to the field to his flock and said to them, 'I see your father's countenance, that it is not favorable towards me as before. But the God of my father has been with me, and you know that with all my might I have served your father. Yet your father has deceived me and changed my wages 10 times. But God did not allow him to hurt me. If he said thus, the speckled shall be your wages, and all the flocks bore speckled. And if he said thus, the streaked shall be your wages, then all the flocks bore streaked. So God has taken away the livestock of your father and given them to me.' And it happened at the time when the flocks conceived that I lifted up my eyes and saw in a dream, and behold, the rams which leaped upon the flocks were streaked, speckled, and gray-spotted. Then the angel of the God spoke to me in a dream, saying, 'Jacob,' and I said, 'Here I am. And he said, 'Lift your eyes now and see, all the rams which leap on the flocks are streaked, speckled, and gray-spotted. For I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed the pillar and where you made a vow to me. Now arise and get out of this land and return to the land of your family.' Then Rachel and Leah answered and said to him, 'Is there still any portion or inheritance for us in our father's house? Are we not considered strangers by him? For you sold us and also completely consumed our money. For all these riches which God has taken from our father are really ours and our children's. Now then, whatever God has said to you, do it.' Then Jacob rose and set his sons and his wives on camels, and he carried away all his livestock and all his possessions which he had gained, his acquired livestock which he had gained in Paddan Aram, to go to his father Isaac in the land of Canaan. Now Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel had stolen the household idols which were her father's. And Jacob stole away, unknown to Laban the Syrian, in that he did not tell him that he intended to flee. So he fled with all that he had. He arose and crossed the river and headed towards the mountains of Gilead. And Laban was told on the third day that Jacob had fled. Then he took his brethren with him and pursued him for 7 days' journey, and he overtook him in the mountains of Gilead. But God had come to Laban, the Syrian, in a dream by night and said to him, 'Be careful that you speak to Jacob, neither good nor bad.' So Laban overtook Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tents in the mountains, and Laban with his brethren pitched in the mountains of Gilead. And Laban said to Jacob, "What have you done that you have stolen away unknown to me and carried away my daughters like captives taken with a sword? Why did you flee away secretly and steal away from me and not tell me? For I might have sent you away with joy and songs with timbrel and harp. And you did not allow me to kiss my sons and my daughters. Now you have done foolishly in so doing. It is in my power to do you harm. But the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, 'Be careful that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad.' And now you have surely gone because you greatly long for your father's house. But why did you steal my gods?" Then Jacob answered and said to Laban, "Because I was afraid, for I said, 'Perhaps you would take your daughters from me by force. With whomever you find your gods, do not let him live. In the presence of our brethren, identify what I have of yours and take it with you.' For Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. And Laban went into Jacob's tent and Leah's tent and into the two maids' tents, but he did not find them. Then he went out of Leah's tent and entered Rachel's tent. Now Rachel had taken the household idols, put them in a camel's saddle, and sat on them. And Laban searched all about the tent, but did not find them. And she said to her father, "Let it not displease my lord that I cannot rise before you, for the manner of women is with me." And he searched, but did not find the household idols. Then Jacob was angry and rebuked Laban. And Jacob answered and said to Laban, "What is my trespass? What is my sin that you have so hotly pursued me? Although you have searched all my things, what part of your household things have you found? Set it before here before my brethren and your brethren, that they may judge between us both. These 20 years I have been with you. Your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried their young, and I have not eaten the rams of your flock. That which was torn by beasts I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it. You required it from my hand, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. There I was in the day the drought consumed me, and the frost by night, and my sleep departed from my eyes. Thus I have been in your house 20 years. I served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flocks, and you changed my wages 10 times. Unless the God of my father, the God of Abraham and the fear of Isaac had been with me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction and labor of my hands and rebuked you last night." And Laban answered and said to Jacob, "These daughters are my daughters, and these children are my children, and this flock is my flock, and all that you see is mine. But what can I do this day to these my daughters or to their children whom they have borne? Now therefore come, let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me." So Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. Then Jacob said to his brethren, "Gather stones." And they took stones and made a heap, and there, and they ate there on that heap. Laban called it Jegar Sahaduth, but Jacob called it Galeed. And Laban said, "This heap is a witness between you and me this day." Therefore its name was called Galeed, also Mizpah, because he said, "May the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent from one another. If you afflict my daughters, or if you take other wives besides my daughters, although no man is with us, see, God is witness between you and me." Then Laban said to Jacob, "Here is this heap, and here is this pillar which I have placed between you and me. This heap is a witness, and this pillar is a witness, that I will not pass beyond this heap to you, and you will not pass beyond this heap and this pillar to me for harm. The God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, and the God of their father judge between us." And Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. Then Jacob offered a sacrifice on the mountain and called his brethren to eat bread. And they ate bread and stayed all night on the mountain. And early in the morning Laban arose, kissed his sons and daughters, and blessed them. Then Laban departed and returned to his place. So we come to this passage, and 6 years have finished since Jacob had completed serving his time for the hands of Laban's daughters in marriage. And he spent 20 years all told in Syria, and he is tired with a capital T. And we don't know it yet, but Laban is constantly changing Jacob's wages, and he's not raising them. So it's not a situation where he says, you know, Jacob, can you step into the corner office with me? And Jacob steps in, and he says, you know, I've seen you've been working really hard, and that frost is really cold in the mornings, and so I've decided I'm going to bump your wages 16%. So what Laban would do is he would say, you know, I had said that you would get all the spotted lambs, but there's been an awful lot of spotted lambs born lately, so let's give you the gray lambs or the streaked lambs or something else. I don't know how they even came up with this, but obviously Laban was trying to get a blessing from using Jacob. He knew that Jacob was a blessed person, and God was blessing Laban through Jacob. Instead, he wanted to get that blessing without paying for it. And so he's constantly changing things, just trying to get as much work as possible for as little pay as possible. That's what employers do sometimes, don't they? They always think you can do just a little bit more, and they can pay you a little bit less, or just not raise your wages for a long time. That ends up being the same thing. So I don't know if you've ever worked in a job where you felt underpaid and underappreciated. Probably a lot of moms feel this way. You could triple a mom's wages and she still would feel underpaid. Strange, huh? And underappreciated. So moms do lots and lots of things and nobody necessarily notices except when they're sick and those things don't get done. And that's kind of sad. So to top it all off, Jacob heard rumblings that his cousins were angry with him for stealing his father-in-law's flocks. And this wasn't really true. So Laban still was pretty wealthy. He had a whole set of flocks that we find out that he was shearing. They were 3 days' journey distant from the ones that Jacob was watching over. And they seemed like they were still pretty good size, but the cousins thought, you know what, our inheritance is shrinking because this Jacob has taken all our stuff. We don't like this. And so Jacob is feeling a little bit less good about Syria. So I don't know how Jacob felt when he arrived in Syria in the first place. Maybe he thought, this is wonderful. My uncle's a great person. He's got beautiful daughters. Here I'm getting married, and I don't have a whole lot, and he's just taken me in. He hugged me when he met me. 20 years later, he says, you know, my father-in-law is terrible. He's a deceiver. He's worse than I am. He gets everything he can out of me, and he doesn't want to pay for it. I'm ready to go. And then he gets a message from God. And that call from God says two things, and two things only. It says, return to the land of Canaan, and I will be with you. And that's enough, isn't it? God doesn't need to tell Jacob all the things he's going to face along the journey back. He only needs to say, go this direction, and I promise I will accompany you. So we'll explore this just a little bit more fully later on, but I think it's important to remember that God's call is not always away from a physical location to another location, but it could be from a pursuit or an activity that we're involved with that is not pleasing to him to something that is more pleasing to him or draws us closer to him. So God could tell us, I don't want you to focus on knitting anymore. I want you to take up embroidery. I say that because I'm not interested in either of those things. So if you all are interested in those things, I'm not saying God is calling you to one or the other, but sometimes God calls us to a different focus in our lives, in the same place where we are, and that's okay. We can stay in Gladys and serve God in a different capacity and still please him. So Jacob went to his wives, and he explained to his wives a number of things, some revealed by God and some just his opinions. He says that Laban is distant from him, seems upset these days, doesn't seem happy with the stuff he's doing, and he says that Jacob has worked really hard for Laban. Laban has changed his wages 10 times. And regardless of what Laban changed his wages to, the flock still bore that kind of lamb. And at this point, God told him in a dream that the flocks were following his wages because of God's blessing. So at some point, Jacob figured out, you know, I'm peeling these sticks. I'm sticking these sticks in front of the sheep, and it is not doing anything. We talked about this last time I preached it. Jacob thought he was being deceptive, and he intended to get the better of Laban with peeled sticks. Well, God says, you know what? You are not getting the better of Laban because of peeled sticks. You're getting the better of Laban because I am blessing you. And Jacob didn't say that here, but it comes through in the story. And he finishes by telling his wives that God had called him to go back to Canaan. So Jacob's wives here have a choice, don't they? And I think that we have to remember that Rachel and Leah had grown up in Haran, and they had probably never been more than a few miles away from home. This was the only home they had ever known. And as difficult as Laban was, he was still their father. And yet we don't see any waffling on their part. They said that Laban treated them like slaves. That is, he was more interested in the money he could get by marrying them off than that they would be blessed in their marriage. He had wasted their money that he had gained by this deal. And somehow, despite being extremely zealous in the pursuit of money, he didn't have as much as would be expected. So he wasn't poor. And I don't think we should read this passage as saying that Laban was destitute, but he worked really hard to make money, and he didn't have near what he should have had. And so if God told them to move to Canaan, they were fine with that. So Jacob then decided to leave on the sly. And clearly this was a decision that was deliberate. I wonder all the reasons for his decision not to share with Laban his concerns and reasons for leaving. And probably there's two sides of this, aren't there? So first of all, I don't think Jacob liked confrontation. Seems like if you worked for somebody for 20 years who didn't treat you well, you would tell them about it, wouldn't you? And yet Jacob doesn't seem to have shared a whole lot. That didn't mean he didn't have feelings about it. It didn't mean that he didn't feel overused and underappreciated. But until Laban caught up with him, I don't think Laban had an idea of how much Jacob was struggling. On the other hand, it seems like Laban was an angry man. Neither Rachel nor Leah seems to have been overly fond of Laban. They saw him as having sold them like slaves to Jacob and used up all the money he'd gained. And he certainly doesn't seem like the sort of person you would sit down and have a friendly discussion with over a cup of cactus tea in the desert. And I'll throw out there that angry men often don't realize how much the people around them have to tiptoe around in order not to upset them. So they think everything is wonderful, but that's wonderful in the way that Pax Romana was wonderful. Pax Romana was a time of peace. It was a golden age, and yet it was a time when Roman authority ruled the world with an iron fist. As long as you complied with what Rome liked, you were fine. And so it is whenever we work around angry people. And yet at the same time, the angry people do not realize the relationships they're missing out on because of their anger. And that's sad, isn't it? And I still think that we see here that Jacob didn't fully trust God. So God had blessed him a whole lot already. He'd given him sheep that he shouldn't really have had. And I don't know what would have happened, but Laban says, and I tend to believe this, that if Jacob had just told him that he wanted to leave and go back to the land of his fathers, that he would have thrown him a big party. And that's probably what would have happened. Not because Laban was a wonderful person, but because God is a great God and had decided to bless Jacob. So then we come to the part of the story where Rachel stole the household gods, or the teraphim. So these were the gods that Laban and his family worshipped, and it seems as though Rachel at least still had some allegiance to them. So some commentators believe that Laban would have used these images as a way of divination to figure out which way Jacob had gone. It seems like a caravan the size that Jacob had would leave quite a trail behind, and it wouldn't be too hard to track him. But I do think that Rachel is an example of someone who has dual allegiance, or is trying to serve two sets of gods at once. She has chosen to choose to serve Jacob's God, but she was also hedging her bets. And yet it begs the question, how good are gods that you can fit into a saddlebag? Unless we're too hard on Rachel, I think there's a lot of Christians these days that aren't that much different. They also are serving two sets of gods. Jesus told his followers that they could not serve both God and mammon or money, and yet an awful lot of us skirt pretty close to this, don't we? And if we read this, if we could read this in the Hebrew, and I can't read it in the Hebrew, but there is a parallel here between Rachel and Jacob. So it says that Rachel stole the teraphim, but in Hebrew it says that Jacob stole the heart of Laban the Syrian. And later on, in verse 26, Laban asked the question why Jacob stole away his heart. And there's a similarity here, and the Hebrew is referring to a mixture of things. First of all, Jacob stealing away the daughters and grandchildren of Laban, but also to the deceptive way in which he'd done it. Both Rachel and Jacob were thieves, or at least so it seemed to Laban. So we come to the part where Laban caught up with Jacob. Jacob had a 3-day head start, but he could only move slowly because of flocks and herds and small children. And Laban had a group of handpicked men on camels, and they could move a lot faster. It still took them all the way to the edge of Canaan, the very border, before they could catch up with Jacob's group. And Laban was super angry at this point. Some people cooled down over time. Laban got angrier and angrier. If he caught up with them faster, it would have been better. But no, he was going to tear some people's heads off by the time he caught up with them. And when he shows up, we see that he says, "You know what? I'm not upset that you left. That's fine. You can go. It's a free country. I'm upset the way you left." And that's the way people are sometimes, isn't it? So if we can't argue with the message, you know, either we shoot the messenger or we shoot the way in which the messenger delivered the message. Because, you know, if they just said it different, it would have been okay. The problem is he said the word is wrong. And I could tell he was kind of cutting up about me. And it's frustrating, isn't it? So many people in this world don't say things the way that you want them to say it. And it's just kind of a bad deal. Then he said that stolen goods are a problem. Somebody stole the idols. And we see here that Jacob had no idea about this. He says, "You know what? You go through the camp and you find anything that's yours, and whoever took it, they'll be killed." And he didn't know Rachel, his favorite wife, had taken these teraphim, did he? So then finally, Laban says, "You know, if God had not appeared to me in a dream and let me know to be careful around you, I would have my way with this camp and not all of you would be going on." So Laban's dream. So we see God's protection of Jacob in Laban's dream. Laban could certainly have done great harm to Jacob. He still viewed Rachel and Leah as his family. And he saw the flocks as his. And this is kind of a weird thing because they weren't his, but he thought they were. They had once been his. But God told him to say to Jacob, "Neither good nor bad. That is, enter into no altercations, use no harsh language with him, which might occasion a quarrel. Say nothing against his going on with his journey, for the thing was proceeding from God." And Laban couldn't argue with that. He might argue with Jacob. He wasn't too worried about Jacob, but he was worried about God. And so Laban looked and he couldn't find anything. And when he came back out, Jacob said all the stuff he'd intended to say over the last 20 years. And he has a list, doesn't he? He says, "I've worked hard. That was probably true. He'd worked really hard. I've endured privation, cold and hot. I had to pay for the normal expenses of shepherding. These are your sheep, and yet you would require of me things. You didn't even split the cost with me. You wouldn't give me mileage. You changed my wages 10 times. And implication here is that he changed his wages to try to get the better of him. And if it wasn't for God's blessing on my life, I wouldn't have nothing. And at this point, Jacob probably felt a lot better about things. And he never brought up the fact that he'd peeled a bunch of sticks and was trying to get the better of Laban too. And so Laban asks for peace. He says, "You are family. These are my children and grandchildren. These flocks got their start from my flocks." And I don't think Laban was expressing ownership here. He was simply saying, "We are family and we need peace." There should not be ongoing quarrels and anger and frustration within family. I've not been the best father and father-in-law. But when I leave today, I want things to be laid down. And that's a good thing. It's probably the first good thing we've seen about Laban since he met Jacob. And I think there's something here for us. Families aren't always perfect, and there are misunderstandings and irritations that can drive wedges between siblings or parents and children. And I don't know what you do if somebody in your family is involved in sinful behavior. You probably have to say something to them. Maybe you need to push them away and have a more superficial relationship. You pray really hard. But many times the issues have to do with personalities. And Laban's words here speak to us. If it just comes down to personalities, lay it down. If it just comes down to money, lay it down. It's not that important, and family is. So they made a covenant, a big heap of stones, and Jacob and Laban called it two different things. We see a difference in the Hebrew that Jacob was speaking and the Aramaic that Laban spoke. But both of these things mean the same thing, a pillar of testimony or witness. And then they made a covenant. Laban brought up two things. Neither he nor Jacob would go beyond this pillar, bearing arms towards the other one, and Jacob would take good care of Laban's daughters and would not abuse them. And then they ate a meal, and then they used some names for God, calling upon him to witness. So Laban calls upon the gods of Terah, Abraham, and Nahor, and he uses a plural form of God, which indicates that while he may respect Abraham's God, he has a belief in many gods. On the other hand, Jacob calls upon the fear of Isaac, and we don't for certain know why he used this term. It probably is a name for God that he's using, but the significance is unclear. And here, Laban returned to his place, and he would never see Jacob or his daughters or his grandchildren again. And it does make you think about the separation that families would experience when they moved a long distance from home. So I'd like to finish up in the last few minutes here thinking some lessons that we can learn from this story that hopefully are applicable for us. First of all, some thoughts on the call of God. So when God calls us, he always calls us away from something and to something else. So when he called Jacob to Canaan, it meant leaving the old country of Paddan Aram behind. And often we aren't ready to listen to God's call until we are fed up with our current situation. So Jesus said, "My yoke is easy and my burden is light." And yoke and burden are things that he is calling us to. And yet yoke and burden have in them concepts of work and challenge. And yet, if we are walking with Jesus, he will see that we're able to follow and to carry the load. I think when we think about God's call, we tend to focus on the where and the who of the call. Where does God want me to be, and who does he want to be there with me? But God's focus is more on the what of the call. That is, he's focused more on the sorts of people he wants us to be and what we are to be doing with our time and resources, regardless of where we are. A few other things stand out to me as I think about God's call. First of all, God's call will always be to a place where we can focus ourselves more on Him. If you are questioning where you should be in your life, the answer is wherever you can be closest to God. If you feel like God is calling you someplace where you know that you and your family are going to struggle with that relationship, that's not God's voice speaking to you. And I can say that without a doubt. God wants us to be where we can be closest to Him. That is His ultimate purpose. And all this other stuff is not that important. Second thing is God's call typically uses the talents that He has given to us. So Jacob was a shepherd, and when he was called back to Canaan, he was not going to become head of a diamond mine or a sword-making factory. He would still be a shepherd because that's what talent he had, and that was okay. God's call requires faith to follow. If we're always making decisions that seem easy and comfortable for us, maybe it's not always God's voice that we're following. If we look in the New Testament, there are certain things, and I'm not going to read these verses, but I'm going to mention them quickly, certain things that God calls us to or away from. So 1 Peter 2:9 says we are called out of darkness. 2 Peter 1:5-11 says that we are called to practice Christian virtues. Ephesians 4:4 says we are called to hope. 2 Thessalonians 2:14, we are called to glorify God. 1 Thessalonians 4:7, we are called to holiness. 2 Corinthians 6:17 and 18, we are called to come out from among them, to be separate from the world, and to avoid uncleanness. And there are a few examples in the New Testament of people who were selected specifically for ministry. So we think of Jesus calling the apostles. We think of Paul and Barnabas being chosen by the church at Antioch. But for the most part, it seems like people were called to serve God where they were. Second thing, moving from that, is the concept of dual allegiance. So Rachel still kept her allegiance to the old gods, even as she tried to follow Jacob's God, and that just doesn't work. There's a poem called The Journey of the Magi by T.S. Eliot, and at the end of the poem, the Magus is coming back from having seen Jesus. And he says, we returned to our places, these kingdoms, but no longer at ease here in the old dispensation with an alien people clutching their gods. And I think a lot of times we feel uncomfortable in certain situations because we realize that even though the people around us claim to be Christian, they are still clutching gods. And if we're honest, we do too. Idolatry is a real problem. It is not just something that the ancient Israelites faced. It's something that modern Americans face. We need to avoid passivity. So I mentioned this last time I preached, but it's telling that Jacob worked for 20 years for Laban, all the time feeling increasingly angry and upset with him. And when he decided to leave Haran, he did so on the sly, hoping that Laban would be far enough away that he wouldn't try to follow him. And some of us hate confrontation. We avoid difficult conversations and situations, and we'd rather sneak away than deal with a hard discussion. And I don't like these things either. And in some ways, it's easier just to create distance than to create healing between two people. And I don't always know how you solve these things. But I do know that when you're in a church body, when you're in a family, you have to figure those things out. You cannot just simply create distance. And passively letting things go just doesn't work in the long run. You just get more and more upset and frustrated with somebody. And then the final thing is make peace. Jesus said, blessed are the peacemakers. And it's far better to be at peace with other people, even if they don't deserve that peace, than to let frustrations go on. And I've been thinking about this a lot, quite simply because there are just a lot of difficult relationships in this world. It's better to deal with it. It's better to sit down, drink some coffee or tea together, have a meal, and listen to someone else. Listen to their hurts, listen to their pain, and make things right. I was thinking about different people who have followed the call of God, and my mind went to C.T. Studd. Charles Studd, many know him as C.T. Studd, was the son of a wealthy British businessman. He was well-educated, an avid player of the game of cricket, and when he finished college, he signed on to go to China with Hudson Taylor's mission to share the gospel. While he was in China serving, his father died and left him the sum of about £29,000. And this would be just a little over $6 million in 2024 money. And C.T. decided that he would give this money away and he would continue to serve God. He devoted his life to ministering, first in China and later in Congo. He battled typhoid. He was often not well, but still he believed in a muscular Christianity that relied on faith to follow Jesus wherever he led. And probably the most famous quote of his, you all have heard this, is from a little poem. It says, "Only one life will soon be passed. Only what's done for Christ will last." Now, I don't know what God is calling you to. Maybe there's some other place in Gladys where you're supposed to be. But what I know for certain is that Jesus will give you the strength to follow the path and satisfaction at the end. Jesus calls us to hard things. He's promised that his yoke is easy and his burden is light, but they are still a yoke and a burden. And this is different from Satan, who claims that there is no burden. There is no yoke. You're your own master. You work for yourself. And yet the hardest life is for those who follow his path, isn't it? And we receive this guarantee. Jesus will never leave us or forsake us. And more than that, he will lift the heavier end of the load and make certain that we can carry on. And I would say this morning that there is nothing more challenging or more rewarding than being fully surrendered to the call of God.